From RunAsRadio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Nguyen announcing show number 627, Aaron Locker with guest Aaron Margosis. Recorded Friday, January 11th, 2019. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell. Thanks for listening to Run As Radio. Back today to talk to Aaron Margosis. And what can we say about him? Last time I had a bio from him, he said he's a Windows nerd focused primarily on cybersecurity. And I'm pretty sure that's still true. How are you, sir?
Good. And yeah, still focused on cybersecurity.
And making a bunch of cool tools too, right? Like you've worked on the sysinternals back in the day and the IE zone analyzer, like all kinds of good stuff. And I think that's our topic today too, is more good stuff that you're making.
That's my understanding, yeah.
Your last show we did was back in November of 2017, so a little over a year ago, when we were talking about sysinternals and your security guidance site, which I reference on a regular basis. And we got a few comments on that show. Okay. I wanted to read one to you. It's just a happy sound. This is from Graham Bull, and it's about a year ago that he wrote this. He said, I've been a longtime user of sysinternals tools, and it amazes me whenever I encounter anyone who's not heard of them before. Maybe it's because I come from a low-level background with C and C++, and I'm naturally concerned about optimal performance and like to know what's exactly running on my machine. So when my CPU usage suddenly goes up, I use Process Explorer to instantly tell me what the offending process is. And when I want to find out what registry keys a process looks at when it starts up, that's Process Monitor. When I want to disable a process that's suddenly running when I log in, that's auto runs. I want to identify a problem that only happens in a release build, like a multi-threading or timing issues, and don't want to risk the performance overhead of logging messages to file, that's debug view. I want to find out which process opened a connection to a certain port, TCP view. These are only scratching the surface. There's so many more useful system tools. Thanks for the great show, and thanks to Aaron. Do you make all those things?
No. That's Mark Rusinovich and Bryce Cogswell. Now just Mark Rusinovich, as Bryce has retired from the industry. I co-authored the books.
Right.
I mean, I've helped out some with the tools, but that's Rusinovich who gets the credit for all that.
Yeah.
But I did co-author the two books with Mark. Including troubleshooting with the Windows Sysinternals tools, which makes a great gift any time of the year.
Absolutely. I got to include a link to that book.
Yeah.
Who maintains those tools these days? I mean, Mark's now like CTO Azure. I can't imagine he's got the time to do work on those things anymore.
He oversees it. He makes executive decisions. He's got people who do do more of the coding.
Right.
It used to be he used to do all the coding. Now he's got people who do the coding, but he specifies exactly what it's going to contain, what it's going to have, what the features are going to be, etc. But yeah, as we've moved, as emphasis has moved away from on-premises machines, on-premises Windows toward Azure, that's certainly Mark's focus.
Mm-hmm.
It has slowed down the pace of new sysinternals tools and the need for new sysinternals tools as well.
Yeah, I tend to agree. The current state of being for operating systems in general is interesting. I mean, we just seem to be more abstract away from OSs than ever before.
Mm-hmm. Yet at the same time, I still believe that the Windows client is still very, very important, particularly because even if you're accessing everything in the cloud, you're doing it from something that you're holding on to or that's at a keyboard that you're typing at. And
Absolutely.
That device needs to be secured. And Windows still is a great platform for that and continues to evolve new security features that enable more secure computing from a client side. So I'm still a fan of Windows.
It's hard not to be. I mean, we definitely need something running on these things that we're holding in our hands or, you know, typing against. So it's just make sure it works well. So it was Chris Jackson. And I see from your blog post, you blame Chris Jackson for this. I had him on the show late last year talking about Windows customers experiences, and he brought up Aaron Locker, and I just immediately reached out to you and said, how did I not know about this? What is Aaron Locker?
So Aaron Locker is the name that Chris Jackson gave to a set of scripts that I wrote. I've been working with a customer trying to use AppLocker to lock down a machine so that, to prevent bad stuff from running, and not doing it in a predictive or a guessing type of way, which a lot of anti-malware does, but just declaratively say, this is going to be allowed to run. Stuff outside of that's not going to be allowed to run.
Right.
And I was using AppLocker for it at the time because, this was a few years ago and, DeviceGuard was not out yet. And now called Windows Defender Application Control, and ran into some issues with it and realized, you know, there's ways of automating our way out of these problems. And I came up with, a set of scripts that enables anybody really to create a robust set of AppLocker rules, that can lock down a system, very easily and very flexibly at the same time. I think it's right now the fastest way to get to application whitelisting is to use the thing which Chris Jackson called Aaron Locker to generate a set of rules. And then, from there it went on to, you know, okay, now that you've got the rules in place, is anything getting blocked by it that we need to allow? Or right. Is anything getting blocked by it and we need to say, wow, it's a good thing it's there. And so the scripts also capture the results out of the event log and put it into highly readable, highly usable form. So that's basically what Aaron Locker is about.
So should we start with whitelisting? Because I think we've talked about this a couple of times on the show, but I still think people struggle with this and much less the right ways to do it. It's just providing right. A list of what apps are allowed to run on machines, period?
So the way a lot of people have looked at whitelisting traditionally has been enumerate precisely what files you're going to allow to execute and then block anything else.
Right.
And the problem with that is it's really hard to maintain. Anytime you need to update an application, add a new application, update the operating system, et cetera, you kind of have to go through and, you know, regenerate the rule set because, mm-hmm. you know, when an app gets updated, you know, the previous rule set might no longer apply. And then, you know, you're facing potential downtime and, you know, problems. So, the National Security Agency, the U.S. National Security Agency, everyone's best friend.
Right.
Because I know they're listening. Came up with a white paper about using AppLocker in a more practical way. And it's basically instead of enumerating everything on the box, just set the expectation that the only users you're going to try to restrict are non-admins. So start with that. If people are running with admin rights, you know, whitelisting is not going to be that effective because there's going to be ways that they can bypass the whitelisting, particularly AppLocker. Mm-hmm. And so, they said, okay, let's start out with a premise that we're only trying to restrict non-admins from running bad stuff. And from there, they can say, okay, start out with the default rules that AppLocker gives you and allow execution of anything in the program files directory, anything in the Windows directory, because those are locked down. If it's in the program files directory, it's because an admin or an admin process put it there. And so we can presume it's okay on this box for a non-admin to use it because an admin said it was okay. From there, though, it gets a little more complicated because if, you know, the assumption that everything under the Windows directory and the program files directory cannot be modified by non-admins isn't quite true.
Right.
In the program files directory, by default it is, but sometimes applications, when they install, will open up permissions on their directory for everyone full control to make it the old Windows 95 security model because, you know, some of these apps are that old.
Right.
And in the Windows directory, there are a lot of subdirectories in the Windows directory that are user writable by default. Mm-hmm. And then if you add in the SCCM client, you get more directories that are user writable. So if you just use the defaults and say, allow execution in the Windows directory, okay, non-admins can now put stuff in a variety of subdirectories and execute them from there. So the NSA's idea was start out by allowing those, but then exclude the user writable subdirectories, and they have a hard-coded list that, you know, based on the defaults in Windows at the time, and they said, apply this. And then they had some guidance about what you could do about things that fall outside of program files in the Windows directory. So that's a good starting point. AaronLocker automates that process by enumerating the permissions on subdirectories in the Windows directory and the program files directories, and excludes execution from those directories by default. Let me see. So we were talking about whitelisting, right? Mm-hmm. So anyway, so the benefit of doing it that way is, as long as you have applications that install in the program files directory and do not modify the permissions there, then you can add new programs anytime you want, or admins can add new programs there anytime they want,
right,
and never have to update the rules. And so it becomes a lot more maintainable than through really any other means.
Presuming, of course, that you're not giving admin privileges to every user.
Well, if you give admin rights to every user, then whitelisting is not gonna
help you.
Whitelisting is, yeah. Because if you're admin on the box, ultimately you can bypass any security measure that's put in place.
Right.
You can make it a little harder for them to do it, but there's no security guarantee that you can make anymore.
No.
Whereas you can make some assurances about what you can allow and what you can't allow, or what the user can or cannot do. Or at least, if it's not a security guarantee, it is a very high wall,
right,
that the user has to overcome. And, you know, there are some published bypasses. If you look for whitelisting bypass, AppLocker bypass, you'll find things online. AaronLocker does a really solid job of blocking a lot of those. A lot of them have to do with the assumption that you won't have any rules regarding DLLs, and then you can just bring in random DLLs and run them with run DLL 32 or something right, like that. AaronLocker does enforce DLL rules, and so a lot of those bypasses are blocked. There's some other tools built into Windows that can be used for bypassing whitelisting, and a lot of those are taken care of by AaronLocker as well. The fundamental rule we're trying to enforce here is, if an admin put it on the box, then it's okay to run.
Right.
Anything that a user put on the box or could have put on the box, we're not going to allow.
Yeah, that's a great summary.
And that kills a lot of the bad stuff that's out there. A lot of the ransomware that's out there mm-hmm. assumes that the end user can run something that
right.
is that they got tricked into downloading. And this can take care of a lot of that problem.
And by your own description here, it's like, this is something that works with AppLockers. This is just a set of configuration rules and scripts to make sure that those settings are right.
Yeah.
So
AaronLocker is basically an assist for AppLocker.
Mm-hmm.
You can use the scripts to do things, even if you've got, if you applied AppLocker rules using some other mechanism. You can still use the AaronLocker tools to view the rules in a more human readable way, because it can extract them out and put them in a spreadsheet, removing all the noise like the GUIDs and attribute names and things like that.
Right.
You can use it to scan directories and see what are the user writable directories, and are there any things in there that we need to potentially allow to execute anyway. So the customizations that AaronLocker gives you, by the way, for things outside of program files, things in user writable directories, just requires simple text file modifications. So there's a set of PowerShell scripts, and you just treat them as text files. You make some very easy customizations to those, and now you can allow WebEx, for example, to run no matter where it gets dropped on the system. All right. So it's designed to be really, really easy to use.
Yeah. So really, no excuses here. You can do this. It's not rocket science. It's just a great set of templates
right.
for using AppLocker properly. And I do
yeah.
see you've put it up on GitHub as well. So the source is all available if people want to look at it and contribute to it.
Yes, it is. I started out putting it on my blog on blogs.msdn. .microsoft.com, but I'm moving it all to GitHub so that, cause that's just a better place for it. I can update that more regularly. You know, I come up with a fix, I can post it right away and not have to worry about like writing a new blog post
right.
and sending out new links and things like that.
Yeah, no, I totally appreciate that. And it also just speaks to, this is the state of things, right? It's like, this is the right place for source code to live in.
Yeah.
Aaron, give me one moment here for this very important message. AppLocker is great, but it's not for everyone and it can't do everything. If you have Windows 7 or Win 10 Pro machines, you simply don't have AppLocker, and software restriction policies are going away. So what do you do? Stay calm and check out Policy Pack. Policy Pack has one-click whitelisting, and it works for your on-prem domain join machines, as well as your always-on-the-go non-domain join machines. Plus, Policy Pack can finally help you remove local admin rights and stop running with the scissors all the time. With Policy Pack, standard users will be able to bypass applications' pesky UAC prompts, let users install their own printers, their own fonts, install their own special applications as needed, and perform other duties you wouldn't normally be able to run as a standard user. Installation takes 5 minutes, and Policy Pack comes with pre-configured guidance to get your implementation of whitelisting and bypassing UAC prompts off and running quickly. Learn the secret that thousands of other administrators have learned about whitelisting and removing local admin rights. Come to PolicyPack.com to start your fully functional free trial today. Policy Pack, securing your standards. And we're back, Richard Campbell on Run As Radio, talking to Aaron Margosis about the infamous Aaron Locker. Maybe it's not quite infamous yet. I am looking at some of the lists of the features and things. Like you're not making huge demands on me either. Just PowerShell V2. So I don't have to be all latest bits of everything to make this work.
V5.
Oh, it is V5. Okay.
V5.1.
Okay.
Yeah. So if you're on Windows 10 already, then
you've got it.
You should have PowerShell version 5.1. On Windows 7, which this also works on, you do want to update to PowerShell version 5.1.
Okay. And I noticed some interesting problems with like BG info needed. You needed to put some rules around that. Like it's just an interesting list of the things you're doing here to help secure machines.
Yeah. So the thing is that AppLocker, for enforcing script rules, the script engine, the script engines have to enforce the rules. So
right.
PowerShell enforces script rules its own way.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it's very interesting what it does with constrained language mode and things like that. C script and W script, the Windows scripting host executables, those enforce rules as well. So that it will check before it runs a script, check to see, does AppLocker have rules around this, and then block it if it's not allowed by the rules. However, it is possible to have a scripting engine that doesn't check AppLocker rules first. And
right.
BG Info is one of those. BG Info, the sysinternals tool, gave you the option of running a VB script, a .vbs file, and then taking the results of that and putting it into the wallpaper, which is what BG Info does.
Right.
And it would not check the PowerShell rules and, or I'm sorry, the AppLocker rules.
Mm-hmm.
And a while ago, Mark added some code to check for code integrity rules, before running script. That helps it if you've got Windows Defender Application Control, formerly known as Device Guard.
Right.
So BG Info enforced Device Guard rules, but that didn't help with AppLocker. And I helped, find how to do that, for AppLocker. And so that code got integrated into BG Info. And so the new version of BG Info is AppLocker aware and does not run scripts that are not approved by AppLocker. And, so the new, the latest version of Aaron Locker by default will block the older versions of BG Info.
Nice. Yeah. And it's just a great little policy and all the more reason for you to make sure you keep all this stuff up to date. I do see that the update to sysinternals was literally December. So it's not that long ago. We're recording this in January. So, this is up totally up to date considerations all around. So the normal process of adding new apps that AppLocker is going to allow is simply having local admin rights on the machine and installing an app. It's still going to work and naturally going to be recognized by AppLocker and be fine with it.
As long as it installs in program files,
right.
Under the program files directory, no problem.
Right.
anything else that installs to the user profile or to program data, you need to come up with some custom rules. And if it's a safe directory, a admin writable only, user read only directory under program data, is not really a place where program files belong, but there are things that end up there. You can just use a simple path rule and say anything under this path is allowed.
Right.
And you know, but if it's a user writable directory, then you have to go to publisher rules or hash rules. Publisher rules are more flexible because then that allows the as long as the updates to the application are signed by the same publisher. Mm-hmm. With the same version information and things like that, the previous rules will continue to work. If it's unsigned code and it's getting updated a lot, that becomes problematic because you have to generate new hash rules over and over again anytime it gets updated.
Yeah, just do yourself a favor. Get set up the certs and use signed code. Like, that's what it's for.
Yeah. Or, you know, if you don't want to rely on signatures, have it go into the program files directory and don't change the permissions. It might require refactoring the app or something, but you know, program files do belong under the program files directory after all. So
yeah, but I appreciate that. You know, you're not saying there's only one right way to do this. You're not saying everybody must have signed code. It's like, no, or you could follow this other set of rules. You can go down the program files path. That's legit as well.
Yeah, you know, if it's in-house code that you're only using, you know, you developed it in-house for your own business. Yeah, I mean, signing is a good thing.
Yeah.
Windows Defender Application Control is a lot friendlier to signed code than unsigned code. But, you know, I get it. It's, you know, if it's for internal use only, it's in a protected directory. I can see not going through the overhead of doing it. Anything professional, anything that's being sold, that's going to, outside of your own organization, that should be signed.
Right. And so regular updates to something like Chrome, which I swear updates almost every day, it's not going to be affected at all by this process. You're just going to get a new version of Chrome.
Let's see. So I always install Chrome to program files.
Right.
So there's Chrome gives you the option to install to the user profile or to program files.
Right.
In a well-managed organization, I don't think having users install their own apps to user profile is that good enough idea.
No.
So I would move toward, you know, managed installation under program files, you know, and so forth. I've not tested to see what happens with, Google Chrome, if it's installed to the user profile. What I've seen is they sign everything that they release.
Right.
And so publisher rules allowing Google Chrome could allow those updates to work, to continue to work.
Mm-hmm.
So it might be, I've not tested it, but you could probably do a per user install as long as you allow everything from, you know,
from the Google
with product name Google Chrome. Something like that.
Well, and herein lies this larger conversation about whitelisting as a whole, which is, are you controlling every update to every piece of software inside your organization, or are you going to allow for automated updates of some things, Chrome being an example? Like, I don't know where you fall on that.
It really depends on the organization,
right,
and the level of control they have to have. If you're trying to control bit by bit every single thing that is going to be allowed to be executed, that can become a management headache, to know every single file anywhere that needs to be allowed to run, which is why the NSA's white paper recommended, look, if it's under program files and the directory permissions have not been changed, just allow it to run because an admin put it there.
Right.
Things in user profile are more problematic because a non-admin could have put it there. The user could have been tricked into putting it there. So you definitely want to be more careful about what you allow there. And that's where you have to
allow
only if it's signed by this publisher, you know, things like that.
I just like the idea of not picking that there's one right way to do all of this, that there's certain classes of apps where you're going to say, I don't want to waste my time keeping on approving these things. I only want to, because then people just start getting blind about saying yes, 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 and don't really study, is this something we allow? If you're going to trust somebody, one of these giants, the Googles, Microsofts of the world, I guess that's the one I would trust, you know, more so than some little company from somewhere else. I've talked to so many folks that they believe they got to go all the way and control every bit so they don't try and control anything. And I appreciate just this thinking that there's a middle ground here.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Because they're looking for perfection and it's very, very hard to get there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And a lot of times they'll just say, well, it's not worth it. We're not going to do it at all. Because the cost becomes very high.
Sure.
And you have to maintain, you know, that level of effort just to allow people to use their computers.
This essential principle of just don't allow domain users to install new stuff into the user level, and they can't install stuff into program files anyway.
Right.
Should handle the bulk of typical malware, don't you think?
It will block an awful lot of it. A lot of the current generation will get blocked out this way. Things that rely on tricking the end user into running something. Right now, this will not particularly help with things that attack through the network, through system level, like the attacks on SMB version 1,
right,
and things like that. This won't help with that at all. As one example, and there are some other bypasses that also need to be contained,
mm-hmm,
including, you know, using Office macros. And Aaron Locker does not explicitly have that in there, but there is guidance in the Aaron Locker documentation about here's some rules that you should implement that will help with that, you know, to restrict macro execution. But that's a problem in a lot of organizations as well. Restricting macro execution without stopping legitimate business processes from running, because
right,
a lot of that stuff's been around for a very, very long time.
Yeah.
Predating trustworthy computing and things like that.
Yeah. No, you're not wrong. Folks that wrote stuff in VBA for Office in 2006 and you're still dependent on it, you don't even know if you still have the code or know how to recompile it or modify it. So it's an interesting problem. A lot of folks I know they've avoided the macros wherever possible, but if you got to make them run, discriminating them is very challenging. I don't know how big of a vector that is these days.
Yeah, I don't know either, and I'm not sure that we have really good visibility into it.
Yeah,
so that also adds a challenge.
Yeah, I mean, Office these days still does quite specifically say, "Hey, this has macros in it. Are you aware of that?" Mm-hmm. Counting on the user to be discriminating is always a challenge for that sort of problem.
Yeah, leaving security decisions up to end users, you know, hitting them with a prompt or something like that is usually the wrong answer.
Because
mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They're not, you know, one of my pet peeves is people saying users are dumb, you know, and stupid end users and stuff like that. And it's not true, because
right,
the thing is, they are expert in what they do.
Yeah.
Right. They're expert at tax law, or they are expert at historical analysis, or a variety of other things. Whatever their job is, that's what they're expert in.
Mm-hmm.
They're not expert necessarily in the arcana of contemporary computer security.
Yeah.
And how do you defend yourself against this week's attack? And people are also very trusting, and that's just human nature. So, you know, these things do happen. And so that's why you don't want end users making security decisions, because that's not what their expertise is in.
So when a spear phishing attack is effective and they've clicked on something they shouldn't have clicked on, and the Aaron Locker rules have kicked in and not allowed this thing to run, do we get a log file entry? How do we know that this may have happened?
Yeah, great question.
Mm-hmm.
So every time AppLocker evaluates a file, whether it's a script or a DLL, EXE, MSI, it will write the result of that to the event log.
Okay.
And with Aaron Locker, you configure it to forward errors and warnings to a central event collector. And from there, Aaron Locker also provides scripts to extract that information in a readable, usable way and generate reports of things. I've got one customer where I'm getting a nightly report of what happened over the previous 24 hours of here's the stuff across the network that that was blocked by AppLocker.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, most of the time, fortunately, I'm not seeing a lot of bad stuff. This network's not necessarily being attacked a whole lot right now. But these are not typical end user machines that this is happening on.
Right.
But there's other environments where, I need to get back. I've worked with some other customers who are now managing Aaron Locker themselves. And I haven't, they haven't reported any problems with it. So I don't know if it's catching bad stuff or if the users know not to try to do stuff. The main thing there is, capturing the data and sending it to an event log. Also working on, Intune management and log analytics as the means of capturing the results.
Interesting to tie it into an existing reporting tree.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause I mean, I don't have a problem with generating an email once a day that says, here's all the places where we had potential attempts to install or, you know, AppLocker fails of some kind. But, anything that's outside of the normal pattern or adding a yet another report, it's just one other place we may or may not remember to look. So it's good to have it tied into the same tree. Well, I'm fascinated that you ended up in this situation, sir. Like this sort of it sounds like an emerged product somehow.
Yeah. It's just interesting. Every now and again, I face a problem and come up with a solution, that's, you know, I think I could say this is innovative. But yeah, I think it can do a lot of good. I think it's, you know, really valuable way to stop a lot of bad stuff is out there. So I'm happy with it.
Well, and making whitelisting a bit more feasible for more people, that folks that are hesitating to even attempt this, having you help us, I really appreciate that, Aaron. Thank you.
Well, thank you for talking with me about it. I appreciate it.
Great stuff, dude. Always happy to have you on the show. And I'm sure we'll be back around again. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you. Anytime.
Okay. And I've included links to your blog posts on these things and the GitHub repository for Aaron Locker. So if anybody needs to find this, they know where to get it from. Anywhere else we're going to see you? What's your next show? Will you be at Ignite?
No. No, I won't.
Nope. You staying in Redmond? You don't do those things anymore?
I'd like to. My session proposals were not accepted at Ignite.
What's up with that?
So, yeah.
Oh, well, the Channel 9 video was excellent. So I appreciate that. At least
thank you.
Some resource.
Thanks.
Aaron Margosis, thanks for coming back on Run As Radio.
Anytime. Thanks again.
And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.